speaker, Henry Lieberman, who's been an MIT product from way back when, including myself. We worked together the AI lab, the logo, on turtle languages, on Lisp languages, and one of the very other expressions in the world. In the recent past, he's been associated with the development of intelligent debuggers and wizards for advising. Today, he's going to talk to us on higher level use of Lisp. Lisp is a macro language, English is a macro language. Get away from the lower level language. So English is a macro language, and here's Henry.
Might be a little controversial, but I hope to get maybe some interesting reaction to you guys. And it's not going to be about programming directly in Lisp, so this might be a little, some of you might consider it a little bit off topic, but it has to do, I think, with some of the traditions in Lisp and where Lisp and other kinds of languages might go in the future. And that's kind of to think of what it might be like to do programming in English, okay, and whether that's a good idea, and, you know, how we might do it, and whether it's possible. And I'd like to acknowledge, first of all, this is joint work with Hugo Liu, my colleague at MIT Media Lab. Okay, so we have this crazy dream that some other people have had since the beginning of time, which is we've all been struggling with these programming languages, and one kind of obvious alternative that sometimes people have suggested, but they've also rejected, is the idea that maybe you could just do programming directly in Lisp. Boy, that was a Freudian slip. Right. Yeah, I know. Lisp qualifies as a natural language, at least in this room, if not elsewhere. The problem is that programming languages are just too difficult for human beings. That is outside this room, of course. The problem was, computers, are very, very precise machines. And English and other natural languages are not very precise languages, but people can express procedures in English, and people can express what they want a computer to do in English. So why not program in natural language? And people had this idea early on in the history of computers. I think it was the original idea, it's fair to say it's the original idea behind COBOL. So the idea of Fortran was to make programming be like mathematics, because it was thought that only mathematicians would want to program. And so if you make programming like mathematics, maybe mathematicians could feel it was natural to do it. But then computers got into the business world, and it was felt that business managers couldn't understand mathematics, and so they wanted to make it easier for the managers to understand what these programmers were writing. And so the idea behind COBOL is, kind of Dear Mr. Computer language, the idea that you write your program in something that is almost like natural language, but as close as you can make it to natural language, but it's still precise enough to be a programming language. So that was kind of the original idea behind COBOL. And you could say in some sense it was very successful, because for many years, and maybe even still, COBOL was widespread in business, but now, of course, it's the subject of some derision. But that was the idea, and in some sense, it did have some success. So the relationship between Lisp, I think the most important thing is that, as a community, I think that what's important about Lisp and the Lisp community is not so much, the particular Lisp language with parentheses and cars and cookers and stuff, but sort of the willingness to really think about how to make programming intelligent, how to continually make programming more and more high level, to try to understand how you can get at, represent concepts in the computers and not just represent numbers or strings and so forth. And so I think that the Lisp community, what I like about the Lisp community is has the tradition of always looking for new high-level programming ideas. And so this is, you know, you can put that in this category. Lisp, the natural language community has had a long tradition of working in Lisp, and Lisp, of course, is a good language for writing natural language analysis programs. And then, as you're going to see, I'm not going to be talking about completely replacing a programming language with English, but to have a kind of mixed strategy where you're using some natural language and some programming language. And if you're going to use a programming language, well, Lisp, of course, is a great programming language to use. So you can think of Lisp as, in some sense, the target language for programming in English. So everybody knows that you can't do programming in English, and, well, what makes you think you can do it, kid? Okay. Well, I think that one of the things that that it was tried early on in the history of computing to make that, and even it still continues today that there's a lot of work in natural language interfaces to databases and things like that. But I think that people, like a lot of problems in AI, people don't appreciate how much the technology has improved. So what happens continually in AI, I think, is that somebody tackles some really hard problem like natural language or vision or speech recognition. So they attack it early on in the 60s and in the 70s, and then in the first attempts to it just, you know, fall flat on their face. So people decide that, well, you just can't do it. You know, after the first attempt falls flat, the second attempt falls flat, within a space of a few years, then people get the idea that it just can't be done. And then they forget about it, and it kind of becomes a taboo thing to work on. Okay. But what happens is that the underlying technologies, both the speed of computers and progress in fields like natural language or speech recognition, just kind of steadily improves over the years. And then after 20 or 30 years, nobody bothers to ask the question, well, can you do it now? Okay. So I think that it's time to sort of revisit the question of, can we do programming in English? Does it make sense to do programming in English? Okay. So the first objection to it isn't English hopelessly ambiguous? Well, ambiguous, yes, but I think hopeless, no. Okay. In the sense that that a lot of the ambiguities that are, if you look a little closely at natural language and why the ambiguities are there, a lot of the ambiguities are in natural language, I feel, in order to avoid sort of premature commitment. So one of the problems with programming languages, they force you to specify everything, you know, exactly as you do it. Okay, and you know, it's really hard to change your mind about something. In fact, programming languages sometimes make you specify something before you do it. You know, that's what the idea of a declaration. Okay, and those things sort of force you to make decisions before they're really needed, and that's one thing that really causes programming to be difficult for human beings. So they force premature commitment to representation. Okay. So ambiguity, I think, is useful, and you'll see in some of the things that we do how that's used. But a lot of times you can resolve the ambiguity, and one way to resolve the ambiguity that people use very often is just common sense. So maybe there's a lot of, so if you say, you know, time flies like an arrow, you know, we know that there's no such kind of fly called a time fly, and they don't love arrows and so forth. So we use common sense knowledge about the world to disambiguate these kinds of things. And one of the main topics that I'm working on in research now, and I don't have time to talk about it other than really briefly, is that we're working on common sense knowledge. We have kind of an open source common sense knowledge base that has 750,000 statements in it. And it's the second largest such knowledge base after Psyche. And we can now do some really substantial common sense reasoning, whereas we couldn't before. And I think what the Psyche people say about common sense reasoning being able to help disambiguate things and aid problem solving is really true. So common sense can often help you resolve ambiguity when necessary. And I mean that in two terms. When necessary, that's if it's necessary, and also just at the time it's necessary, again, emphasizing that programming languages tend to force you into premature commitment. The other thing is interaction can help you resolve ambiguity. So, this is what happens in natural language between people. If somebody says something, the person doesn't understand it, you can always ask them the question, what did you mean by that? Okay. Or if you have something where it's natural language in and code coming out, if the programmer can look at the code and see whether the code is right or not, they can correct it. So, in some sense, we don't have to get the whole thing right. We can rely on interaction to resolve ambiguity when and if it's necessary. Okay. So these are just some of the resources that we have for common sense reasoning. Again, we have a knowledge base called OpenMind, created by my colleague Push Singh, and he started by just putting up a website where he had a box that just said type in some common sense knowledge in English. And of course, we all laughed at him. But now, after 4 years, we have 750,000 common sense statements here. And so if you ask it about what does it know about a wedding, it'll say, you know, a wedding has a bride and a groom. Of course, it may not be true in Massachusetts or some other places. the bride wears a wedding ring, the bride wears a white gown, the couple go on a honeymoon. Okay. So you get just a lot of common sense facts about weddings simply by asking it. Hugo Liu is my colleague who's very, very expert in natural language, and he ran kind of state-of-the-art natural language schools, some of which I'll talk about later, and some of which I want to put in a plug here for Ian Eslick's talk. Ian, are you in the room? Yes, back there. Ian Eslick is going to talk about the natural language toolkit that he and Hugo have put together, and Ian has a version that's in Lisp. And it's a version based on common sense knowledge. So the idea is that a lot of natural language tools try to separate the parses. What they do is they do the linguistic analysis, and then they come up with all the possible ways to parse the sentence, okay, many of which are ambiguous. And then they assume that later on some pragmatics or some common sense knowledge is going to later on go figure out which one of those meanings is actually true. And in some of the, in Multilingua and Langutils, what the kind of approach is, because we put in the common sense reasoning from the start, and we just don't generate a lot of the language possibilities that don't make sense. So for time flies like an arrow, we wouldn't generate the thing that says take your stopwatch and time the flies the same way your time is speeding arrow. So, you know, we just don't generate a lot of those parses that otherwise would be ambiguous. Okay. And the other representation that we have is we did Hugo and Ian made this thing called ConceptNet, which is kind of mining a semantic net from these 750,000 statements. Okay. And so by taking patterns of something is a something else, or you use a something to do something, use a fork to eat your food. And that kind of thing, and we produce a kind of semantic net. It's still very rough. You know, we just take out the curse words, but we don't really do a lot of filtering on it. These concepts are not precise as they would be in, say, a semantic web ontology and that kind of thing. But we do have but the upshot is that we have a usable, very large and usable, it's about 300,000 nodes, about 1.6 million relations. We have a usable semantic network that encodes, again, a very, very small fraction of human sense, common sense knowledge, but a large and substantial portion of that. So we have these resources for common sense reasoning, and they actually help us in programming, because when you program, very often, as you'll see, when you go from language to programming, assumptions about common sense everyday objects and everyday interpretations do play a big role in even being able to interpret the natural language to come with some sort of programming object. Okay. I won't talk about some of the linguistic processing in great detail. You can ask me some questions about it later, but we can, and I can refer to some of the papers, but I want to really talk about now some interactive things that we've built with it. One of the things that I was inspired with was a study that Carnegie Mellon University did called Natural Programming. How many of you are familiar with it or have heard of it? No? Okay, I'm surprised. All right. John Payne and Brad Myers at Carnegie Mellon, they tried to figure out what is natural in programming. So they tried to do some studies of non-programmers to see how they would describe things that we would consider programs. And they did two studies. One is they showed fifth graders a Pac-Man game, and they said, describe what's going on. They just showed them the game. Describe what's going on in this game. Write down some sentences. You can draw pictures to describe what's going on in the game, but just get a description of what's going on in the game sufficient to that a programmer could program it from reading your description. There was another study where they took college students and they gave them a spreadsheet programming task, and was, I don't know, add up columns of numbers and make various summaries and that kind of thing. And then they tried, and then they said, okay, describe what this is doing. That was a lot worse. We had much more fun with the fifth graders' descriptions of Pac-Man. And what we did, just to start, was to look at those fifth graders' descriptions of Pac-Man and say, how much of this can we understand? Hugo put them through some of his natural language analysis tools. And they're based on the Brill part of speech tag, or some of you might be familiar with that. And so we put these fifth graders' descriptions of Pac-Man through the thing, and then we used our knowledge of programming. We just said, how much of this can we understand? How much of this corresponds to what a programmer would put into a program? Now, of course, there still are a lot of ambiguities and incomplete things in it, but the upshot of it was that remarkable amount of stuff that the fifth graders said about the Pac-Man game really was programming. They were telling you what the objects were in the game. They were telling you what the objects did. They were telling you the rules in the game. It just wasn't in a programming language. It was easy for a person to understand what was going on, but it just wasn't in a programming language. Okay. And we found that we could extract a lot of this information directly from the thing. Now, what Payne did, Payne was a PhD student of Myers, what he did was he analyzed some of the properties of it, and he found out, so for example, one of the things is that almost nobody talks about loops. Okay. So everybody talks about kind of sets. So they don't say, okay, we're going to start a loop now. Every time around the loop, what you do is keep track of this, that, or the other thing. You know, nobody says things like that. Okay, what they say is, Pac-Man eats all the dots until he finds the biggest one, or that kind of thing. It applies a loop, but it sounds like what you're talking about is set iteration. So they extracted a number of principles from those things, and then they designed a programming language called HANDS, which kind of embodied some of these principles. And it was a nice programming language. It was a visual programming language, but it wasn't anything special from my point of view. It was just, they were inspired by this study, but they didn't actually try to make what these fifth graders said about Pac-Man. They didn't try to make that the programming language. And so I thought there was an opportunity there to try to actually go farther than they did. John and Brad were kind enough to give us the data for it, so we had all the data from both the spreadsheet study and the Pac-Man study. And then we looked at it, and I just want to show you just a tiny sample of this, and so this is what the typical fifth grader would say about Pac-Man. So it says, the yellow dots are set through a maze, and Pac-Man, the chomping yellow circle, has to collect them. There are blinking big yellow dots that allow you to eat the ghosts. Okay, and I especially love this little thing where you put the picture of the ghosts in parentheses. We haven't quite figured out how to have the natural language system deal with that. But this may not be a complete description of the game, but it makes perfect sense. Everything that the user is saying about this is actually true of the game. Okay. Yes, John?
Does the programming language have any loops?
Which programming language? Yeah.
The programming language that they hooked up from the show.
No, it's all set iterate. It's all sets. It's all set iterate sets. Mapping over sets, selection from sets, that kind of thing.
Well, the one Larry Tesler had such a language, and the thing it couldn't do was find the biggest piece of cake.
It's not just iterate over the set and ask the size of the thing.
Yes,
the
maximum. You have to find the normal way of doing it is you have the biggest so far,
That's what I'm talking about, not saying explicitly the loop, but you know, talking about finding the biggest one. That's sort of what we're talking about here.
Is that, first of all, for a child, to find the biggest piece of cake is a reasonable task. and it will go through and compare. So the child will, in fact, perform a loop, whether it has, whether it speaks in loops or anything like that or not. So, how do we know that this language is even remotely adequate?
Well, we don't. But what we did was we analyzed it, and let me go on, and I'll show you sort of what we did. But we don't know it's adequate. Okay. But if you ask the other question, which is how much of what's saying here, you know, is actually reflected in the program or can be, then the answer, you know, we have an answer to that one, which is, you know, a lot of it or most of it.
Let me rephrase my question. Yeah. Is it adequate for describing what children actually do? For example, finding the biggest piece of cake.
Yeah. Not in. Yeah. Not in general, but for a lot of cases in this kind of thing, yes.
Isn't there a distinction between what a child actually does and how he expresses how he does it?
Right.
I'm sort of struck by the fact that you're assuming that there's a loop in the program. Because, I mean, for all I know, I assume there is. I don't know, I never looked at the program for Pac-Man, but there are many ways you could represent all the objects, and might be in a tree. And finding the largest is just doing some kind of a tree recursion as opposed to iterating through a loop. I think it's an important distinction that when you specify what it is that you're trying to do, the implementation details could vary widely under that. And as programmers, we sort of fixate on a few canonical examples, but
right.
It's a really good exercise to lift up to the higher level and abstract away from those details.
What we're trying to get is not, when I talk about using natural language as a program, you'll see this a little later if I ever get to my demo. You'll see this a little bit later. What we're trying to do is not so much reproduce, you know, having it be just language is just like reading the code. But we want to sort of reproduce in some sense the dialogue that might take place between somebody who's not a programmer and somebody who's an expert programmer. Okay. And so that was saying, you know, I want to find the biggest thing. And the guy who's the programmer is going to be the one who actually, you know, writes the loop first, you know, expresses it that way. Just one more question, and then I'd like to go on, John.
So if I follow your technology so far, you can compile general English assertions into parts that imply decent algorithms, but you would also discover places where those algorithms are underspecified.
That's right. That's right. Exactly. Okay. So then the question becomes, and given what John just said, suppose you can understand some English things, but you can't understand everything. So then what good is that? Okay. So you can imagine just a dialogue where somebody says English and code comes out and you try to run the code, and then the code doesn't work because it's ambiguous or you didn't specify something, and then it won't be of use at all. So you might imagine that kind of thing. And that's actually what happened in the history of natural language interfaces to databases. You know, if it got it wrong, there was kind of nothing you could do. And so what we want to try to do is make the interaction fail-soft. So we want to rely on dialogue to resolve between between the human and the machine to resolve ambiguities and errors. So, for example, if there's an ambiguity, if the system can tell there's an ambiguity, the system can ask it. Say, when it says Pac-Man, the chomping yellow circle, comma, eats the dots. Okay. You could say, I'm sorry, I know what eats means, but I don't know what chomp means, and you've got to tell me what chomp means. And then the other thing is, and of course, you know, in errors, that, you know, we can work on debugging, and we'd like to have debugging proceed the same way by natural language dialogue. And the other thing we try to do is not eliminate the code entirely, but instead we want to emphasize the correspondence between language and code. Okay. So that the idea is we want to turn some language into code, have the user look at some of the code, and then see whether it's doing the right thing, and then have interaction with the system if it's not. Okay. So we've implemented this in a system called Metaphor. And you can think of Metaphor as kind of an outliner for code. The intent is that it's not for use by somebody who doesn't understand any code, but it's used for really a beginning programmer. And you can think of it as an outliner in the sense that an outliner for prose writing is something that you do to just sketch out the top level of what you're doing. Okay? And you use it as a brainstorming tool. Okay? It helps you manage the overall structure or figure out what the overall structure should be, but it doesn't fill in all the details. But hopefully it's helpful in giving you kind of the big picture. So what we want to do is go from English to what we call scaffolding code, which is partially specified code. Okay? And roughly what it does is it turns the nouns into classes and instances. And we're trying to be a little clever about, you know, when we're talking about a class versus when we're talking about an instance. Okay? We want to turn the verbs into functions or methods. You know? We want to turn the adjectives into instance variables. Okay? And then we want to do some linguistic tricks that we have about resolving an aphorism, so to say it or them or something, you know, going back to the context. And I'll talk a little bit later about the problem of context in languages. That's really important. We want to untangle things like conditionals and loops. So I just talked about loops or, you know, conditionals. If you say, you can say if then, that maps pretty well onto code, but you might say otherwise or just in case or except when, and there's a lot of different ways of saying conditionals or saying things that apply loops. And in general, we call this whole business of trying to figure out which natural language expressions map to which code expressions, we refer to that whole thing as programmatic semantics. And so now I'm going to show you a demo. Okay. And this is just the interface. Okay. And now the microphone is in front of my glasses. Okay, so unfortunately, we have Hugo is a IBM PC kind of guy, and I'm a Mac kind of guy, as you see. So there's no accounting for tastes. Okay. So what I'm going to show you is Hugo's implementation on the PC. And again, I have to, I'm using virtual PC. I hope this is going to work. Okay. And I do have to admit that, again, there's no accounting for tastes. So Hugo is a fan of Python. Okay. Which, you know, shares something with Lisp, but it's, you know, in terms of philosophy, but it is not Lisp. The current version Hugo's code is in Python, but it has generators for Python and for Common Lisp. Okay. Ian will talk again on Wednesday at 2. A lot of the language technology that Hugo has had is Ian has implemented a version in Lisp, which we're also making available open source. So you're welcome to play with some of this stuff. And so we're going to think about a metaphor, a version of metaphor, which is totally in Lisp. For the moment, the implementation that we have is on Python on the PC. Before I start, let me just tell you a little bit more about the domain of it. So you do have to kind of think about a particular domain of this. And our target domain is moves. How many of you know moves? Okay, about half. Okay. All right, so they're, you know, text adventure games, you know, from the old original adventure game about the colossal cave. And I think, so we like this because game itself is an interactive narrative, so we don't have to worry about programming graphics and other things that get hairy. Another thing that is interesting about moves is that the natural language, so there is a parser, you know, that lets you talk in nouns and verbs. You can say anything you want, okay? And not only that, but the parser is really stupid, you know? And somehow, people learn how to deal with it. The interaction is successful. People learn what you can say and what you can't say. They put you in situations where what to say is obvious and stuff. So this is the kind of interaction. Say Miranda gives you a hug, Mal says I'm here to hug you, and so forth. So the various characters and the inanimate objects put a lot of programs with it. Programming language that lets you, which is sort of, again, sort of English-like, or sort of COBOL-like, that lets you program these. And so the idea is for us to use actual English natural language to be able to program these bugs and moves.
How does it deal with the misspelling of friendly?
I guess, you know, it wouldn't work.
Actually, he has a table of commonly misspelled words, and he maps it to the right word.
Yeah, we use a spelling checker. Okay. All right, so basically just pay attention to the bottom left-hand window and the bottom right-hand window, where we'll see the translation. Okay, there is a bar with a bartender who makes drinks. Right, that's the Python, but you didn't see that. Okay. All right, so this is the Lisp here. So just a little macrology here. So def object is, you know, just def class, but it just packages, it automatically defines accessors and gets rid of all the options that def class has. And so we have a class called bar. It has one instance variable called the bartender with an A here. That's just macrology for make instance. Okay. So we have def, and I apologize, it isn't pretty printed, but we have def object bar, so the bar is an object, the bartender is an object, and then make is a method that the bartender can do, so it's on the self, which is the bartender, and the bartender can make drinks, and the drink is the argument to the make method, okay? So one of the things is that we are, and you can see in this example even, how we're using some of the natural language stuff, because we said, when we say, there is a bar with a bartender who makes drinks, you have to know that it's the bartender that makes the drinks and not the bar. Okay. So we're using, so that's a potential ambiguity that we're resolving, because simply we know the common sense knowledge base has a bunch of facts about bars. So, you know, we know it's the sense of bar is a restaurant where it serves alcohol rather than a chin-up bar or a Hershey bar or all the other senses of bars that you might have. And then we know that a bartender is a person who works at the bar. Yeah, question back here.
What's a drink and why did you get that?
Okay, let's. That's a good thing. Hold on a sec.
Okay.
The bar. Has a menu containing some drinks, which include sour apple martini and rum and coke. Okay, what we're seeing happen on this window on the top left here is just kind of a trace of what the natural language converter is doing. And there's just all this stuff you see on top, the deictic stack. So, you know, if you have to say him or her or she, you know, what that might be referring to. Okay. So let's look at the code. So now we have def object bar, the bartender. So it has, so we know that there's a bartender in the bar. We know that there's also a menu in the bar. Okay. We have def object bartender. We have make, same as before. Okay. And we have, so what do we know about the menu? We know the menu has some drinks and a list. We have an extra level of parentheses there. That's not good. But we have a list of drinks. A list is a sour apple martini and a rum and coke. Okay. So the idea is that as you type in these sentences, it's accumulating more knowledge about the program. Because, you know, sometimes it knows what these things are because it can look them up in the common sense knowledge base. Sometimes it doesn't, so it just makes some assumptions. A typical assumption is that if you don't know anything about something, then it's probably a constant, okay? But then if you learn something about it, so we have sour apple martini, how did it know that, it doesn't know anything about sour apple martini? So later on we might say, a whiskey sour, okay? and then it might decide to actually change the structure of the program where, you know, Sal is a property of something rather than part of the name. Mike?
Yeah, so how did it know that rub and cope is one thing as opposed to two things? Was it linguistics or was it
sometimes?
Okay, now, you know, some of this stuff it's going to get, some of this stuff it's not going to get, okay? But it's a pretty, you know, the idea is that it's making kind of reasonable assumptions. Now, we might or might not have sour apple martini in the knowledge base, yeah.
I guess the broader question is, can you, like, tell when it's using stuff in the common sense knowledge base up there?
Yeah.
Is there a trace of that or something?
Well, not directly, but... So I guess, you know, just one of the slides I made about that kind of particular point is, well, a couple of things about these things is that there are different narrative stances, so there are ways you can describe a program. So you say, I want to make a bar. So if you say something like, I want to make a bar with a customer, which is another way you can say it, then this is the, you know, it's a, you're making a first-person statement where you are taking the role of the program. So when you say, I want to make a bar with a customer, I refers to, you know, Henry the programmer. Okay. If you say there is a customer in the bar, then you're taking a narrative stance where, you know, you're kind of God's eye view and you're describing something in the objective thing. But, you know, again, the effect is the same. Okay. You want to say, I am a customer sitting on a stool. So sometimes an object during the programming, you kind of shift into taking the point of view of the object itself. You pretend to be the object, and you say, when I read something from the screen, then I process it, so forth. So you can take, you know, that's kind of the object-oriented thing, where you take the point of view of being part of the program and you describe it from an internal rather than external viewpoint. Okay? And or you can say, the bartender said, here is a customer, where you can describe kind of a, you kind of think of yourself as being the playwright, and then you describe each, you know, in, as kind of a playwright would, you describe sort of in an objective way each of the characters in the third person. John?
At what point does it have to distinguish between the fact that the menu doesn't contain drinks, it contains names of drinks?
Yeah, right. But the idea is to try to not make distinctions like that in advance, but only when it's required by something in the program that might talk about it.
How do you know that you won't make commitments that prevent you from making that distinction when it's...
Well, our thesis is that there are no, you know, you can always change your mind, is that, you know, there aren't any commitments that you aren't, you can't overcommit yourself in that way because you can always back out of it.
You might have built a structure that is committed.
Yeah. Well, this is, so, I mean, one of the things that I think that we can do that's very interesting is we can, you know, we can do what programming is often called refactoring. So the idea, is this the one?
Yeah.
That we can perform a certain amount, maybe not all of it, but a certain amount of refactoring. So, you know, if you say, there is a bar, that's just saying, okay, there's this object that's called a bar. I don't know anything else about it, so it's sort of treating it like an atom. Okay, you say, the bar contains two customers, that implies the existence of a list, and that the list is unimorphic, so it, you know, contains all the elements of the list are the same. That we have nothing to distinguish between the two customers at this point. Okay. And you say something like, it also contains a waiter. Well, that's referring to some context, the context with two customers. But now we're talking about, you know, there might be some polymorphism in the list. The bar opens and closes, so that's talking about the bar in the role of being an agent. There's a class. The bar is a kind of store, so you know, you can have inheritance, or there might be more than one kind of bar. Some bars close at 6 p.m., and so that, you know, might imply that there's a subclass there. Yes,
so what you're saying is you deal with these things by sort of refracting its previous commitment and regenerating.
Right, mostly regenerating.
Which is how you keep from being locked into it.
Where exactly. Okay? Yeah.
You said that you can use interaction as a way to resolve ambiguities. Just go back to the example there of we had the drink, whatever, the rum. is there any way of directly, you made the assumption that the two combined at the same rate, is there any way of directly correcting that assumption?
So how would you correct it, or what would you think?
Right, is there any way of directly addressing it, or do you have to then add some of the people knows that it will then backtrack it and correct that assumption?
Yeah, well, some of this, so right now what I'm just showing you is kind of the initial translation of it, you know. To that we want to add a dialogue model, you know, where that will allow explicit correction.
Okay.
So, but what I'm just showing you is just kind of, you know, the initial way that it can, it can form that transformation. Okay. Okay. All right, so that was just sort of some simple examples. I'll show you something a little bit more complicated. When the bartender is asked to make a drink, he makes it and gives it to the customer only if the drink is in the menu's drinks. Otherwise, he says, "Sorry, I don't know how to make that drink to the customer." Okay, let's see what that does. Okay, I create a new agent for the customer. I have the ability for the customer to say something, and then it, let's see what we got out of that. Okay, so we have the bartender, and we have make. Okay, and right. So I said if right again, we're a little bit off on the parenthesization here, but if this was supposed to be saying, you know, if the drink was a member of the drinks menu, then. I'm afraid we didn't get this right.
It might be a translator talking about the Python.
What?
You might look at the Python.
Yeah, let's see what the Python is doing.
Can't read it without parentheses.
Well said. Sorry.
All right. Well, still a few bugs in the system, folks, but you know, it's almost there.
No, it's actually not a well, other than being Python.
Right.
It's not a bug. You actually wrote a sentence which is ambiguous as to which the reference of he and when the drink was made and things like that. Mm-hmm. I mean, there may be brand bug cards, but what you wrote is horrifically ambiguous. it shows some random interpretation of it.
Yeah. Okay. All right, but you know, that's kind of, I think you can, you know, at least get an idea of what it's doing here. Another comment? Yeah.
Okay. Well, the question is whether at this point, now that you saw that it generated code that is incorrect, whether you can, by typing in some sentence that is more precise, whether it would be capable of fixing its own bugs.
Right.
I know it was the bartender that fixed it.
Right.
Or the sorry.
Doesn't government binding theory rule out he equals customer?
Okay, so, yeah, so I mean, right now this doesn't have any kind of dialogue model, but one of the things that we're thinking about working on is trying to, you know, add to this a kind of dialogue model. So, and I think the inspiration for this is some of the work in sort of mixed initiative planning, there's the collagen system of Candy Seidner and Chuck Rich, where they have a thing where, you know, users and some agent maintain a dialogue stack, and you're able to, you know, work on some roles from time to time and so forth. And so you can imagine this is just a mock-up of the kind of dialogue that we might have talked about in the game. So if you say we're going to program a game, Pac-Man, well, Pac-Man is the name of the game, But then the system can say, what does it already know about games? And what are the ways, you know, if you have a kind of game programming toolkit, you can say that the major tasks in making the game are things like deciding what the playing field looks like, the characters, and how the user can control the character plays. This is for a graphic game like Pac-Man. And then there needs to be some sort of scoring system. And then this sentence, of course, was the sentence that was, you know, in the original fifth grader thing, saying the yellow dots are set through a maze and Pac-Man, the chomping yellow circle, has to collect them. So, you know, if you know what a maze is, then you can feed back the definition of a maze. Okay. And you can say, well, you know that the description of Pac-Man is the chomping yellow circle, but I don't know how to chomp. And for a graphical program, then we'd like to integrate it, you know, in with some sort of way to draw the graphics in the way that the fifth graders, you know, do those things and put the little ghost in parentheses or something. I'd really like to give you the ability to be able to do that, okay? And use some techniques from programming by example to be able to generalize this stuff and make credit. Can't hold on to my mic. Okay, and so, again, where it sees a verb that it doesn't understand, when it sees a verb it doesn't understand, then it can ask you for a definition. Basically, what it tries to do is get you to go down to the next level of abstraction so that you specify it more and more precisely until it's in the terms that it can think. So if it doesn't know what eats mean, then in terms of a game, when you draw Pac-Man, you have to alternate between a picture of Pac-Man with his mouth open and a picture of Pac-Man with his mouth closed, and that's the eating chomping. So we'd like to try to use that kind of thing as a way to disambiguate it and deal with errors. Okay, so English is a programming language. I don't know if I've convinced you or maybe, you know, but I think that I hope to at least have make you think that maybe it's not such a crazy dream after all. So basically we're human beings. We're wired to understand natural language. We're not wired to understand programming languages. And there's programming languages are easy for the computer to understand, but natural language processing, I think, is now evolved to the point where we can understand enough of some of the more interesting aspects of natural language that we can think of going beyond what could be parsed with context-free grammars and, you know, BNF and so forth. So, and I think that if we think about the interaction design, we can there are ways of using natural language, and hopefully I'd like to even take it to using speech. The speech recognition is now getting good enough that we can even think about programming through speech. And I think that we, you know, with some interaction design and some facility for dialogue and error correction, we can make natural language programming somewhat fail-soft, at least, you know, no worse than programming is now, which is pretty bad. So, in closing, I'd like to say that maybe COBOL wasn't such a bad idea. Thank you. Yeah, I didn't do that study. You can look it up with Greg Myers and John Kane.
I noticed that you didn't really touch on the analytical abilities involved to understand what it is you're trying to describe as a programming language. For instance, I could see you're talking about a Uber type game. You might try to describe it as something like adventure. You say that there are locations in the game, and each location has four exits, north, south, east, west, which will take you to a different place.
Right.
Unfortunately, the problem with that specification is that I just described an infinite grid, which if you try to represent it with, well, you have no memory to represent that. So
use less.
I just specified that there's an infinite number of locations.
Yeah. Well, but you don't have to create all the, you create those, you don't have to create them all at once, right?
Yes.
Right,
but I'm just saying that there's always going to be cases in which the user is specified something that is ill thought through, that would be better thought through if they were working in the domain that the actual computer is working in, but because they're thinking in this natural English language area,
Well, I think that's, so I mean, the hope is that by having their English turned into code, even if it's wrong or ambiguous and stuff, they'll say, oh yeah, by seeing that, then they'll see it was wrong, and then maybe be led to think more precisely about things, but just as they're needed to. But, you know, the problem is always everybody's trying to solve the hardest problem, and nobody solves the easiest problem.
So yeah.
You just said, and your example earlier implied, that the way you gauge the correctness of your program is to take a look at the code. Have you considered getting the software to repeat the
yes.
code back to you in natural language?
Yes, and
okay.
Yeah, so
what you really mean is...
That's right. So we're going to have a third render. So we had a Python and Lisp renderer there. We're going to have a third renderer, which is English.
Yeah.
That's, yeah. Somebody who hasn't spoken yet. Yeah.
What sort of program do you want the people to write in this? It would seem that I would kind of hope that it wouldn't be, you know, nuclear power plant drones or something.
No.
but it would seem that I sort of like programming because it forces me to think very specifically about something, and it's actually. It seems to me that I am better at thinking about things I don't really understand in programming languages than I am in English. This would seem to not enforce that discipline on you, and also require you to understand code to debug the thing. Unless the dialogue session got really, really good.
Yeah, well, we do want to make it, yeah. Now, I mean, that, of course, is an argument. Some people say you don't want to program, you shouldn't want to program in natural language because, you know, that it should, you should want to think more precisely about some stuff. And I think, to a certain extent, that's true, but I think it's an open question. I think that a lot of people feel alienated from programming, you know, all the English majors in the world, you know, because they can't, what they can express clearly and easily in natural language, they feel frustrated that it's so difficult to express the simple things in programming languages. You know, maybe the most subtle things, you really do need a very precise programming language to express precisely. But it's very, it really keeps a lot of people from using computers in interesting ways, simply because what they can easily say in natural language is so difficult in the programming language.
What implication would it be that they would...
Well, like, for example, programming these MUDS things, or kids programming games, or, you know, learning programming, you know, or just, you know, casual business programming where there isn't very much subtlety. Yeah.
Well, I just want to follow up on that. You had your example of the outline earlier.
Right.
And I do think that there are a lot of cases where you have this a hierarchical task decomposition where you eventually get down to a set of operators that work in some world.
Yes. Now, you know, in software engineering, there's been a lot of work on, you know, using natural language for what they call requirements gathering, or they use some phrase like that. You know, and typically, I think they have that idea that somehow you should be able to go from language to something that's more formally specified. But generally in software engineering, nobody proposes actually trying to use natural language programming, natural language processing to actually give you assistance in doing that in an interactive environment.
I can give you a pointer to one paper at least.
Okay, I'd love to have pointers. To do that. There's also work in natural language interfaces to databases, you know, again, where people have the idea that, yes, you should be able to say some things in English, but, you know, but they don't really propose doing it in an interactive manner where we're doing it here. Is that true in that?
Yes.
Yeah.
It seems to me you're going to run into the fact that there's an ill-defined boundary between the common sense the thing already has and we're trying to define.
Right.
So somebody might say something like, well, I want a bar. And it's just like a real bar, except it has no bathroom.
Right.
Something like that. So, and then the system comes back and starts hammering you with these little questions about things that you assume it already knows because it knows about bars, doesn't it? I mean, it seems like the system is either going to not infer enough from what you describe or maybe infer too much.
Yeah, and so I mean, one of the things that you'd like to do in that kind of case is have a dialogue. You know, sorry, I just came down from Mars, and I don't really understand what a bar is. Can you tell me what a bar is? You know, and they say, yeah, a bar is a place where alcoholic drinks are served. A bar is a place where, you know, people get so drunk they want to forget about their lost girlfriends or something. You know? So, you know, and hopefully we can even augment the common sense knowledge base that way. You know, if you can elicit common sense knowledge from people. You know, in the course of doing something like that, then maybe you can grow the common sense knowledge base that way. Yeah, in the back.
There's a lot of cases here where you have a lot of boundary conditions, edge cases, and that kind of stuff that the user may not specify up front. And you know, it's almost like you're supposed to see that it's missing that boundary condition, and then say, oh, but when this happens, I want you to do this instead. You know, do you really think that you can deliver an application like that to an end user, like in a game, for example, if the interaction is underspecified?
Yeah.
And then another player in the game comes in and starts, using an object that you just designed. How are you going to come in and say, intervene when the other person tries to use that object and hits a boundary condition or something that's ill-specified?
Well, look, I mean, this doesn't get you out of, it's just like any kind of programming is, you know, it doesn't get you out of programming and testing and this sort of thing. So, you know, any program that you write, whatever language or natural language, you know, it can have bugs in it, it can have ill-specified stuff, it can have stuff that causes errors. And the way you work with that is, you try it out, you get people to test it, and then, after a while you've done enough testing so that you think, most people will be able to come at it, without problems. But, it doesn't, we don't say, there's no guarantee that the programs that come out of this are fully specified or any better even than the program done conventionally. Mm-hmm. Yeah, one more? Okay. All right, one more and then we're done.
Isn't that what happens when you have a game? If you play Monopoly and you see children play it, they make their own rules, and if they don't understand exactly what happens in the instructor, this is what we do with natural language.
Right.
So if you want to make a program, use a programming language in the classical way.
Yeah.
If you want to develop something, and then you can always continue developing while you're using it.
Yeah. I mean, in some cases, when this kind of system gets really good, you might imagine a system where the end user themselves can program it by saying things, they can actually, change the game, by saying, I want the bar to have a door, Okay. Thank you very much.
Reminder once again, Dinkelspiel, 8 o'clock tonight. We'll take a 10-minute break and come back for Dick Gabriel's address.